For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
John was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dunton, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the Liberals converge on Canberra to discuss the party's position on net zero by 2050.
Is it, you know, abandoning the legislated targets but actually looking towards some of the aspirations that the Paris Agreement has? Is it abandoning all of that altogether? And I think they're the discussions that we'll have in the party room today.
So, can a party divided compromise on its views and reach consensus? You'll meet one of the politicians in today's meeting. We'll also turn to political chaos across the Tasman in New Zealand.
It's pretty big for them. This is the scale of it. It's a third of their party they've just expelled, and the internal ructions are running deep.
You'll find out why the Te Pāti Māori Party in New Zealand has just expelled two of its MPs. And then to Washington, where Donald Trump is brandishing a new relationship with Syria. All that coming up. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thank you for joining us for another edition of The Breakfast Wrap. I hope you heard yesterday's, presented by Lexi Junowick, covering that special 50th anniversary of the dismissal. Radio National Breakfast had a live program at Old Parliament House with a live audience. You can hear all the best bits wrapped up by Lexi Junowick. You can find it on the ABC Listen app. But today, political negotiations at new Parliament House. Liberal Party members gathering today to discuss their energy and climate policies. It's the first in a series of meetings this week, aiming to settle the coalition's energy position. Remains uncertain as to whether the Liberals will follow the Nationals and dump their commitment to net zero emissions by 2050. Before the meeting got underway, we wanted to hear from someone who'd be in the room. Sally Sarah interviewed the South Australian Liberal Senator, Leah Blythe.
Do you personally support your party maintaining its commitment to net zero by 2050?
Personally, I don't. I think that net zero isn't working for the Australian people. The economics of it and even the environmental impact that net zero will have just doesn't add up, I don't think, in our national interests.
Do you think that the Liberal Party will abandon its commitment to net zero entirely this week?
That is the sort of million-dollar question this week, and particularly today. We're all converging on Canberra to have that, you know, very important discussion in our party room today. And I think there are, you know, obviously there are colleagues of mine that have the opposite view to me, and it will certainly be a very good process for us to have a genuine debate and come up with a position that's in the best interests of the Australian people.
Informally, what would your view be of whether the majority of your colleagues are in favour of net zero by 2050 or not?
Oh, look, that is a really hard one, and there is nuance in that. I think all of my colleagues are absolutely in favour of us doing our bit and to certainly have the minimal impact that we can on our natural environment. And so I think, you know, is it, you know, abandoning the legislated targets but actually looking towards some of the aspirations that the Paris Agreement has? Is it abandoning all of that altogether? And I think they're the discussions that we'll have in the party room today. But I think the really important thing is everyone in the coalition is committed to doing what's right for our economy, for the environment and for the Australian people.
Do you support Susan Lee's leadership, and will you continue to support her leadership if your preferred policy position doesn't align with the party by the end of this process?
I sit in shadow ministry, and it is a long-held convention that to sit in shadow ministry, you support the leader, and I follow that convention. I don't think this is, you know, a referendum or a vote on the leadership per se. I think this is a policy discussion that we're having. And so, you know, my views of the leadership and that support that I have for our leader doesn't change pending the outcome of this policy debate today and later this week.
So would it, in your view, be possible to continue to stay in the shadow ministry if the party arrives at a different view from yours?
I don't want to preempt what decisions are made today and then into shadow ministry tomorrow. And of course, we have a joint party meeting later in the week. I think, as I said, you know, cabinet solidarity. I support the leader. And certainly, you know, I don't want to get into hypotheticals, but if things change, I would have that discussion with the leader. But, you know, as it stands now, there's a policy discussion that we're having and I have, you know, full confidence in our leader and Susan.
Do you think it's the right thing to do that if members of the party room disagree with the position of the leader that they should not remain in the shadow ministry?
I think that's a matter for each individual. And as I said, you know, it is a long-held convention of cabinet solidarity. And so I think if there are individuals who feel as though they can't uphold that principle, then that's certainly a decision for them to come to, and again, a discussion for them to have with the leader.
Given the result at the last federal election, which former Liberal Senator Simon Birmingham labelled as, quote, diabolical, do you believe that a change in net zero policy will help the Liberal Party to rebuild in your home state, South Australia, and elsewhere at the next election?
I think that we went to the last two elections, which were not the results that we have been hoping for. And I think former Senator Birmingham is probably correct in describing it as diabolical. But if we're going to keep doing the same thing and expecting different outcomes, I think that would be naive of us. We've never taken a differing position to Labor on this to an election and won. So I think it is time for the Australian people to have choice. But for us, it is, you know, what is in our national interest? And that's got to be a question that I think even Labor is going to have to ask itself. When you look at the price tag that comes with net zero, and there are numbers that range between $7 and $9 trillion, you know, we've got to ask at what cost and what is the tangible benefit to the global environment, but also to the Australian nation. And I think the numbers just don't add up. And if we impoverish ourselves, aspiring to a target that is legislated and quite frankly is not achievable, and we're going to impoverish the Australian people to do that, I don't think that we can be stewards of the environment if we can't afford it. So I think this has got to be a discussion on balance, and that's what
I'm
excited
to take. Can you afford not to go down the path of net zero, the costs of not doing enough?
I think Australia is 1% of global emissions. We are still sending our coal and our gas offshore to be burnt and used to make products that we're then buying back. I don't think we can not afford to have a sensible discussion about what Australia's future looks like. And I think at the moment we are doing our sort of emission reduction at many times the rate of what comparable nations internationally are doing, and we're crippling ourselves doing it. And I question whether that's a sensible policy.
And you were just listening to the South Australian Liberal Senator Leah Blyth there, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. So our political correspondent, Melissa Clark, picked up right from where Leah Blyth left off. And at the end of this, you're going to hear her tell us about another story making news out of Canberra.
I thought her comments around emphasising about care for the environment were really important, because I think we're going to hear a lot more of that from the Liberal Party. Whatever the position they land on, we're going to hear more of this description from them. As Leah Blyth put it, our colleagues are in favour of doing our bit to minimise the impact on the environment. They really want to emphasise that this doesn't mean they're climate deniers. It's a speed question. It's a way to go about it question. So I think keep expecting to hear that from both moderates and conservatives as they go through this process. But Sally, as for how this is going to play out today, there's what's planned and then there's what actually happens. And we're not sure what will actually happen, but as to what's been planned. So today there's going to be a party room meeting. All the party room members will attend, all the MPs and senators from the Liberal Party. They'll hear about the position put forward by Dan Tehan, who is the Liberal spokesperson on this issue, has been doing the work of trying to develop a policy position here that can be a unifying position. There's a chance for everyone to speak. And the leader, Susan Lee, is trying to get everyone to settle on a position rather than have it come down to a vote, a yes or a no on something, wants to try and get to a consensus position so that tomorrow the shadow ministry can finalise a position, with the idea that then after that some senior Liberals and Nationals can come together over the few days following that and on Sunday reach a reconciled coalition position with the Nationals. Now, that's the plan. There's many stages at which that could escalate. There's no guarantee as to how this will play out. Today's meeting is really crucial on this. I guess the reminder or what's in the back of minds here is that we've seen similar points for the Liberal Party before, going back to Malcolm Turnbull as opposition leader in 2009, when there was discussion about what the coalition should do around the CPRS that was being put forward by the Rudd government. At that point, Malcolm Turnbull was at odds ultimately with where the party lay, and that led to him being rolled by Tony Abbott. So you would never say that this process is a definite that Susan Lee has set out, but that is what is expected to happen.
And the federal government has asked the Nauruan president about reports that criminal bikie gangs were awarded a contract to provide security for former detainees transferred to Nauru. Mel, the Nauruan president was brought into Parliament House for, let's say, a discreet meeting yesterday.
I think that's a fair description. David Adiang had an unannounced visit with the Foreign Minister and Home Affairs Minister here at Parliament House yesterday afternoon. He has been in Australia with a number of other Micronesian leaders taking part in some events connected with the Australian National University. But this meeting was an extra one just for the Nauruan president. He came through the Senate entrance, and I'll just explain why that's important, because often when you have the leader of a foreign country visiting, often even if it's not a full state visit with all the bells and whistles, they would still normally come through the front of the building, sign the visitor's book. There's usually a little bit of ceremony about it as well. But David Adiang turned up through the Senate entrance where diplomats would normally arrive discreetly when they have meetings. It was only a brief meeting. We think it went for about half an hour. A spokesperson for the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, has said that this was an opportunity she took to meet with him separately and that she raised recent media reports with him. And likewise, the Home Affairs Minister, Tony Burke, put out a statement saying he had a productive meeting with Nauru's president, David Adiang.
Political correspondent Mel Clark there, talking about the Liberals and that last story, this previously unannounced meeting between Nauru's president, David Adiang, and Australia's Home Affairs Minister, Tony Burke, at Parliament House. So let's stay with that story. Sally Sara interviewed David Shoebridge. He's the Greens spokesperson for Home Affairs, Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs, as well as Foreign Affairs, Peace and Nuclear Disarmament. Quite the mouthful.
Yeah, good. That's a list. But in this case, Home Affairs.
What's your response to the Nauruan president's visit to Parliament in Canberra yesterday?
Well, I mean, it's extraordinary that the Labor government, having just cut a $2.5 billion deal with one of our nearest neighbours, then sneaks the president in the back door, fails to show up for any questioning, is shielding the Nauruan president from any questioning from Australian media. I mean, only a government that is embarrassed by the deal that they've cut and potentially embarrassed by questions that will be put to the Nauruan president would do that. There are a bunch of questions that I think the Australian public deserve some answers from. We're not getting them from Tony Burke, and we might have got them from the Nauruan president in a press conference, but instead they literally snuck him in the back door, told nobody.
It was the Senate entrance?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been in the Senate entrance. I can tell you it's not the public entrance. There's no media at the Senate entrance. It's designed to shield a pretty cruel deal, in fact, an extraordinary cruel deal, from scrutiny. Secretly deporting people to Nauru, a secret MOU with Nauru, secret payments to Nauru, and now a secret meeting from the president of Nauru. This is one of the least transparent governments we've ever had. And on this case, this is about a deal which pretty much every human rights advocate and organisation says is a gross abuse of people's human rights, deporting them to a third country they have no connection with.
We'll look at that in a moment. But just secondly on this visit, is it right to call it a secretive meeting? The president was already here for a Pacific Security College leadership program. Is it unusual to have informal or unannounced meetings?
This is a head of state of one of our closest neighbours that the government has just cut a $2.5 billion deal with, and the Minister for Home Affairs, and as I understand it as well, from a very small amount of information in the public domain, the Foreign Minister have just had a meeting with. Yes, if no one knows about a meeting, I think it is 100% fair to call it a secret meeting. And this is an important secret meeting with a country we've just signed a $2.5 billion deal laced with cruelty for.
What questions do you have about this meeting, given we've seen the first members of the NZYQ cohort being sent to Nauru last month?
Well, I think one of the first questions that we would have asked the Nauruan president is, does he stand by his comments where he said he wants to return the people who have been forcibly deported to Nauru, who are, we understand, well, overwhelmingly have been found to be refugees. Does he stand by his commitment and his position that he wants to return them to the country that they came from, which is the country where they were found to face persecution, potential torture, and are found to be refugees from?
Under the legal system here in Australia, they were it was ruled that this cohort had no legal right to be here in Australia. Does Australia really hold responsibility now they are in Nauru, and are the responsibility of the Nauruan government?
Australia absolutely has responsibility. Once having found that people are refugees, Australia can't do chain refoulement. We can't send them to one country where they stand a risk of being deported back to the country that they fled from. Instead of being prepared to answer those tough questions, Tony Burke, Penny Wong, the Labor government, have decided to shield the Nauruan president from those questions. They sneak them in the back, don't tell anyone, and only put a tweet out when they're found out.
David Shoebridge there, speaking to us as the Greens' spokesperson for Home Affairs. Well, let's head overseas to a rather fascinating meeting held at the White House this week. He was once branded an international terrorist by the US government, but Ahmed al-Shara has gone from rebel to ruler. He's become the first Syrian president ever welcomed to the White House, where he's held landmark talks with US President Donald Trump on rebuilding ties with Washington and cooperating in the fight against the Islamic State group. So how is this being received in the capital? Someone watching closely is Caroline Rose at the New Lines Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington.
This is an extremely significant meeting. It's the first of its kind. The White House had not received the head of state from Syria beforehand, and of course, in a post-Assad chapter after the fall of the Assad regime in last December, this marks really a new level of acceptance and a willingness to engage and support this new chapter in Syria's history. It also indicates that Trump and his administration, they are very much willing to take relations to the next level, specifically with President Ahmed al-Shara, who used to command a U.S.-designated terrorist organization called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham.
What are the risks of having had this meeting for the United States? Could it all go wrong? Could it backfire down the track?
I think there is always that risk. And really, I think that the last year in Syria, as we've seen the ascent of Ahmed al-Shara and several HTS commanders, there's this question of can people truly change? And of course, can a country change after over 14 years of civil war? I think that we have seen some demonstrated change with both Ahmed al-Shara personally, as well as, of course, the policies his new administration has implemented. It's very clear that they are committed to, for example, cracking down on illicit crime. They're also committed to accountability as well as economic recovery. We've also seen some measures such as the introduction of elections, as well as, you know, trying to expand access to different communities as well as across the sexes. I think that that has also indicated that HGS fighters that are now in this new administration, they have demonstrated some change. But still, the country is mired by sectarian tensions. We've seen violent outbreaks both in Latakia as well in Soweda, where some governmental forces have actually participated in that violence. And so that very much creates cause for concern moving ahead and also a risk for the United States.
How significant is Syria in the current Middle East context for the United States and for the international community?
They're extremely important. They have historically served as a corridor for Iran's campaign of influence, otherwise known as the Shiite Crescent. And they've played host to a number of not only Iran-sponsored militia networks, but also great powers like Russia, for example, staging their forces in the country. They access or they provide access to warm water ports in the Mediterranean. And of course, their central position in the Levant is strategically important.
Caroline Rose there from the New Lines Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington. She was talking to Sally about that meeting between the new Syrian president and the US president, Donald Trump. Well, in politics a little closer to home, just across the Tasman, the decision to expel two of New Zealand's Te Pāti Māori MPs has left the party in disarray. Maria Meno Kapakingi and Takuta Feres were dismissed this week in a unanimous vote from the party's National Council. It's led to headlines describing a collapse and comments from the opposition leader that the Māori Party still isn't ready for government. Both expelled MPs have issued public statements calling their removal unconstitutional, with vows to appeal the vote. Tracking the political chaos is chair of the New Zealand Parliamentary Press Gallery and senior political journalist at The Post in New Zealand, Anna White. She gave Sally a sense of just how big this story was over there.
It's for the party, they have been going from strength to strength, having six MPs, and they just recently came home with a stomping by-election win with bringing in a new MP. It's pretty big for them. This is the scale of it. It's a third of their party they've just expelled, and the internal ruptions are running deep. Mm.
And Anna, what led to this decision by the party council of the Māori Party?
There's a lot of confusion around this. We did ask, so we were at the press conference on Monday when Debbie and Ngāriwa Pika and Dawiri announced this. It was kind of hard to understand why they got removed, and the MPs have also said that as well. On the background, so what kicked this off, Takuta Feres, so he is the MP for Te Saitonga, which is like the South Island in Wellington, he did a post where criticising a Labour MP for having non-Māori helping with a Māori seat election. The party came out against that and he pushed back. On the other side, Maria Meno Kapakingi, so she's the other MP who was expelled, had allegations against her that of misspending, and the allegations against her son, both which have pushed back on this. So that has been going on in the background. The co-leaders did try to explain what happened, but there are so many question marks left.
Well, just another bit of political drama to keep across over in New Zealand. Anna White is the senior political journalist at the news outlet The Post. She's also the chair of the Parliamentary Press Gallery. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. As always, you can listen to Radio National Breakfast live at 5:30 a.m. on Radio National and also the ABC Listen app. And you'll be able to hear Sally Sara do all those interviews live right across the morning. Interviews produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap, that is today, produced by Josie Asher. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll see you right back here, same time, same place, tomorrow.